Good morning. Once again, welcome to South by Southwest, I think we should be calling it this year. Although I do understand that the weather is supposed to change, so hopefully that will be good. And let's work here. There we go. So I am Dave Hoag. I'm an applied psychologist. I am also a user experience designer, and I'm the vice president of experience design at Fluid in San Francisco. We also have an office in New York. That's all of my contact information there. And just so that you know, we do have a hashtag that we are using for this presentation. It is SXSimplerUX. So feel free to comment along. I'll follow up with things afterwards. So, complexity is easy, actually. We can make anything complex, including our wristwatches. So, this is a common device. Almost all of us have one on. We look at it all the time. We very rarely, however, interact with it. We only interact with it when we actually need to change the date or the time. And that's where the complexity comes in. Because our watches tell us just a few pieces of information, hour, minute, second, day, date, things like that. But when it comes to changing it, well, it's not so easy. Most of them have three or four buttons, and you have to do things like press this button twice to enter editing mode. Press this button to choose what you would like to change, hour, minute, second, day, date, year. And then press this button to begin making changes. So 11, 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And if it's an AM, PM, you got to go through another 12 to get to the correct hour. And then you have to go through the cycle again, 5, 6, 12 more presses in order to get the time to change. And this is actually a copy of an instruction sheet that comes along with a digital watch on how to change the time. Notice the instructions are not how to read the watch. They are how to change the watch. So, not much has changed since digital watches were first introduced. The Pulsar watch there was the world's first LED watch. That was introduced in 1972. And if we take a look at watches that you can buy online today, we see that they still tell us time. We've added some additional functionality like chronographs and altimeters and barometers and things like that. But they still have three, four, or five buttons. And in order to change them, we have to go through a very carefully choreographed sequence of presses and holds. Just a reminder, daylight savings time starts tonight. So at 2 a.m., do you know how to set your watch? Or come tomorrow morning, are you going to be asking everyone, what time is it? So how do we make things simpler? What do we do? We first need to define complexity, which, ironically, is not simple. If you actually just do a quick web search for define complexity, you'll find a dozen different definitions easily, as well as people commenting on, I don't get this. So let's just start with a simple definition. And what is this without a slide that has something from a dictionary on it? So the word complexity comes to us from the Latin complexus, which means entwined or twisted together, which kind of makes sense because a lot of things that we describe as complex, we could also describe as twisted. Complexity is something that's difficult to define, yet each of us says, I know it when I see it. Now, this is obviously a famous phrase. This is Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. In 1964, when asked to define pornography, he said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And complexity is exactly the same thing. We know when we're dealing with it, but there are so many facets to it that it's actually difficult for us to come up with just one definition. So we're going to try and come up with a definition today, and we're going to do that by taking the perspectives of three different groups of people. We're going to include designers, which I assume many of you are. We're going to include people, or the users, but we're also going to add a third group here. We're going to add scientists. Now, I'll confess, I had a little bit of internal turmoil when I put the category people on here, because it sort of implies that designers and scientists are not people. But we are, of course. We just tend to think a little bit differently than the people that we are designing for. So let's take a look at how different people define complexity. Let's start with designers, and we'll start off with our visual designers because they're concerned very much about appearance and aesthetics and style. We hear words like clean and simple all the time. So we want to make sure that there's sufficient negative space, right? Things aren't too crowded. We want to avoid visual noise. And yes, there is actually live HTML text on top of that repeating background. Good luck reading that one. And we're also concerned with hierarchy. So this example, great example from the blog over at Typekit, on the very left shows us what is actually complex text. It's not a big message, but it's difficult for us to extract. What's the key information? What's secondary information? And what's just supplemental detail? But as we start to add typographic hierarchy to it, suddenly we see what we should be paying attention to. And then we add some graphic detail to it, and the eye is drawn to precisely where it needs to be. A presentation on the typography of Paul Rand, and we get all of those details. It's much easier, much simpler for us to extract meaning from the message on the right than it is from the message on the left. As UX designers, as interaction designers, we've got so many titles, we're very concerned about how things work. So we pay attention to functionality. What's the context in which people are doing things? What do they need to do? What is their goal or what is their motivation? And we're concerned about flow. How do people move through these experiences, step by step or in a non-linear way? So when we take a look at things like web pages, we're concerned with how does it work. This is a web page for updating your profile information. But it's not a simple experience, and it contains a lot of things that don't seem to be related to my profile. So yeah, there's some information up there about me, but then there's this cryptic section in the middle about what marketing information would I like to receive. And then there's wonderful section down at the bottom where you have the opportunity to spam all of your friends without their permission by including their names and email addresses in the newsletter list. So somebody decided this is how it needs to work, but from a user's perspective, this isn't exactly a simple experience. But it's also potentially a dark pattern. We're going to come back and talk about patterns and dark patterns shortly. But in this particular case, this is also the page that you land on when you say, you click the link at the bottom of an email that says unsubscribe, and it brings you to this page. Somewhere in that page, there is a checkbox that says, I don't want to receive your newsletter, along with all of the other information. Okay? In case you can't find it, it's at the very top, just above email. It's nowhere near where the actual newsletter options are. We're also concerned with what people's goals are. What's the context in which they are interacting with something? It's that time of year, and for those of you who are U.S. citizens, you recognize this. You probably just had a slight little visceral reaction where your guts turned around on the inside. This is the Federal Income Tax Form 1040. Is your goal to pay money, to get money, to avoid the process altogether and pretend it doesn't exist? Now, you can imagine what the task would be to design a digital experience to walk people through this, because this is the paper form, and we see how dense this is. But understanding what people's goals are and how they need to work with something is very important. It is possible to make something like this a simpler experience. We're concerned with structure. How are things organized? How are things connected? It's fascinating running around a conference with a bunch of designers and listening to the things that people complain about, right? Because we have insights into the experience. And so you're standing in the airport and people complain about the signage. You're standing at the convention center and people complain about the mobile app or about how the registration line works or about why you can't find a particular room or a booth. So we are very, very focused on structure and organization, because it's that structure that helps us move through the experiences, that gives us this direction, this flow forward. We also like to make fun of kiosks, and in particular, parking garage kiosks seem to be a popular target. This is a three-step process for paying to get out of a parking garage. There are two sets of instructions and five arrows. All I want to do is leave. Why is this difficult? Let's take a look at how people define complexity, because it turns out that the people who are using our designs and products think about complexity differently than we do. So Jared Spool and his team over at UIE did a great study last year. They were hired to do an intranet redesign for a company. And they went in and they, of course, started with interviews. And they talked to people and they said, well, what's the problem with the intranet now? Because they looked at it in advance. And they said, well, you know, it's not really a crappy design and it seems to have all of the functionality here. So let's figure out what the problem is. And as they started talking to people, they said, it's hard. It's complex. It's cluttered. I can't find what I need. It doesn't do what I need it to do. And so they started watching what people were doing. What are the tasks? What's the information? And they noticed that many of the key tasks and much of the key information wasn't available on the landing page of the intranet. It was, in fact, there. You just had to go look for it. So they did a simple redesign, and they pulled the most important things forward, and they put them onto the new intranet homepage. Now, the new design actually had more content, more links, and less white space than the original design. In other words, it was visually denser and potentially more cluttered. So they were a little concerned when they took it in to show it to the employees of the company. And when they put it in front of the employees and said, here, go ahead and do your job, make it work, is this okay? They loved it. It's simple. It's easy. I find what I need. And it turns out that what their concept of complexity was is actually based more on relevance and not on the same criteria that we think about. If I find what I need when I need it, it feels simple, even if there's a bunch of other stuff around it. So clutter gets in the way, but so does irrelevance. Some tasks are difficult, and people recognize that. It's hard to fly a fighter jet, right? That's why the U.S. military has standardized the cockpit layouts of all of their planes. If you learn how to fly one plane, theoretically, I can drop you into any of them. The gauges are in the same place, the buttons and switches are in the same place, the stick works the same way. I can fly it around. Okay? But it is a complex task, and we can't get around that. And people recognize that hard tasks, difficult tasks, are often complex tasks. But that difficulty factor, that's going to come back. And finally, confusion leads to people calling things complex. My family recommended that I watch this film, Frequently Asked Questions, about time travel. Has anyone seen it? Anyone? None? Okay, well, I think I know why. Because I haven't been able to find it either. It's a British film. I just wanted to buy it or stream it. I did a web search looking for a source for it online, and one of the pages that I came to was this site. And I still don't know what this site does. It didn't have a download link. I didn't stay very long. And finally, let's take a look at how scientists think about complexity. And here we're actually going to talk about the concept of chaos. Anyone familiar with chaos theory at all? A few hands go up. Good, thank you. Well, let's start with a simple example because it's one of the first that was really well studied. Back in the early 1960s, Edward Lorenz was studying weather and wanted to know, why can't we predict weather very accurately? We can get out a few days, but then beyond that, our forecasts are actually pretty crappy. And if we try to do a longer-term forecast of weeks or months, well, our accuracy rate's near zero. So he approached this from the perspective of a physicist. And he knew that there was a set of equations, very simple differential equations with just a handful of variables that describe the thermal convection patterns in the atmosphere. And so he took measurements and he made predictions and he plugged them into this equation. And the first thing that he found was he still couldn't predict the weather. He had equations to describe it, and he still couldn't predict it. So he took these massive sets of data that he had used to model the weather, and he did what's called a time series plot to see, is weather random? Is there something funky going on here? And what he found was what is one of the most famous attractors in science, and this is the Lorenz attractor. This diagram, this picture, describes visually the convection patterns of the air in the atmosphere. Now, it's obviously a system that has structure. It's bounded. We can see that it's not random. Why can't we predict what the weather is going to be? Well, it turns out that behind that system is chaos, and chaos has several characteristics. One of them is that these are dynamical systems. In other words, they are ever-changing. It's not static. The weather doesn't stay the same from day to day. It changes from moment to moment. but it is deterministic. In other words, we do have equations that we can use to describe it. But unfortunately, it's not predictable, but it's also not random. And that's the catch with chaos. Chaos is not random. Chaos is structured. Chaos is deterministic, but you can't predict it. But out of chaos comes self-organizing systems. You can see this in the way the clouds move. You see it in the storm systems, like a satellite view of hurricanes. Okay? There is an emergent structure that happens, and this structure emerges from the actual properties of the system itself. The weather patterns organize themselves. There's no outside force that makes weather happen. And they are sensitive to perturbation. And what this means is that a small change now can produce a huge change in the future, which is what makes them unpredictable. So our modeling of weather has gotten better. It used to be that we could tell things a few days out, then it was a 5-day forecast. Now it's a 7 to 10 day forecast. But beyond that, well, we're still pretty crappy at predicting it because weather is chaotic. Now, Edward Lorenz wrote a book about this. You probably recognize the term, the butterfly effect. He said, does a butterfly flapping its wings in Texas have the potential to cause a tornado in Idaho? And what he really meant was a very small change in the system in one place can produce a very large change in the system somewhere else or in the future. So, some things are just naturally complex. Complexity is intrinsic in the system. So why are we discussing chaos here if there's nothing that we can do about it? Because it gives us a way to think about the problems we're trying to solve. Complex systems appear to have an impossibly large number of variables. Just think about weather and the atmosphere around the entire planet. But it can actually be described and understood with remarkably few variables. Lorenz's equations had 6 variables. That's it. Thermal convection in the atmosphere, 6 variables. Still can't predict it, but we know what the equations are. So let's take a look now at what I call the complexity curve. When we start a project, we're optimistic, we're energized, we're excited. This is awesome. We can do this. It's going to be fantastic. I understand it completely. We know what we have to accomplish. And then we begin, right? And we very quickly realize that, you know what? It's a little more complex than I thought it was, and there's more than I had thought about, and stuff happens along the way to increase the complexity of the problem that we're trying to solve. Things like stakeholders saying, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, it also needs to do, and the list grows. Our own ideation processes open up opportunities for us, and we say, oh, wouldn't it be awesome if it also did? And then we add to the list. We have people who review things later on and say, it's looking great. Now, let's add this one more thing. Or let's change the way this works. Or, you know what, I don't want that anymore. And so it continues to change. And eventually we get to a point where we're approaching the completion. We know we're going to have to actually create this thing. And then we run into something like, oh, sorry, the system doesn't support that. We don't have the technology for this. Not enough memory, it's not fast enough, it's not good enough, whatever it happens to be, we're going to have to do something else. We need to work around that. Let's trim it back. Let's pare it down. And eventually we get to a point, depending on whatever process you use, agile or otherwise, you reach a point where you say, okay, I'm feature complete. Everything in the list has been checked off. No one has inserted anything else to the list. What we have achieved at this point is a product that is maximally complex and feature complete. But we're not really done. We're going to talk about the second half of the curve in a few minutes. Let's talk about some of the things that happen on this upward swing, where we go from the start of the project to that peak of complexity. So where does complexity in our projects come from? Well, first, let's skip the obvious, and that is disregard for design. If you simply don't design something, don't be surprised if you end up with a complex mess, right? That's why we have websites like Web Pages That Suck, and why there are 790 groups on Flickr with the phrase bad design in the group title. There are many, many sources of things that have gone wrong. Remember, complexity is easy. Simplicity, not so much. So let's start with the designers. what happens in the designer's workflow that we have to deal with that may contribute to increasing complexity of a project? Well, we're all probably familiar with, I hope, familiar with the concept of mental models. We talk about things like, what are people's expectations for how something works? And then, of course, there's the reality for how it really works. So we have the mental model, and this is the person, this is the user, this is their expectation. I want it to work a certain way. Then we have the conceptual model. This is the designer, the developer, the manufacturer. This is how the device is created to work. And then we have the system model. And this is what's on the inside, the guts. This is how it really works. And this is what people most often don't need to see, right? It's like that old story about sausage making. Everybody likes to eat it, but nobody wants to see it being made. So we don't want to see the system model. We want the mental model and the conceptual model to match. In other words, we want these three models to be consistent with one another, because when they are, we flow through the experience, and it's much easier. However, if we have a mental model mismatch, if something doesn't match up between that mental, conceptual, and system model, we run into problems. Things like getting in the way, we impede progress, there's an extra step or additional information or a surprise event along the way. We interrupt focus. Anyone who has ever stopped in midstream in a task and asked yourself, why does it work this way? That's a mental model mismatch. You've shifted your attention from the task and what you want to do to the device or the interface, and now you're questioning why it works the way it does instead of having it do the thing you want it to do. And it may even lead to incorrect direction. We end up in places where we didn't realize we were going to be, like the Box Office Mojo site, and I was trying to download frequently asked questions about time travel. How did I get there? I don't know. I'm just going to go back. Designers are also familiar with design patterns. We use them often. And I'm going to give some examples of negative uses here, but it is important to know that design patterns can be effective, so I'm just showing how design patterns can be a source of complexity here. When we copy patterns, solutions that have been applied in other places, we might not copy them effectively, or we might borrow a pattern and it's not really solving the problem that we're faced with. So there's a couple things happening here. AMC Theaters has two websites, one where you can buy tickets to see movies in their theater, and one where you manage your loyalty program, in other words, the points that you earn for watching movies in their theaters. They're separate sites, separate accounts. We already have a problem there, right? It should all be in a single experience. But they've decided to borrow patterns from one another, and that's this idea of password security. So they have requirements about has to contain a certain minimum number of characters, there's got to be special punctuation, there's got to be at least a capital and a number in there. Well, the problem is the sites are disconnected, and they actually have different password rules. So the password that works on one site isn't going to work on the other. And they don't even tell you what the password rules are until you enter a password that is invalid, and then they return it in an error message. So they borrowed a pattern, they copied it across two sites, and then they didn't even tell you that the rule exists. So clearly we've got a problem here. Password security is a good idea. How you implement it, on the other hand, can lead to complexity. Anti-patterns, these are commonly recurring solutions to common problems, but they're often non-optimized. In other words, they're familiar, a lot of people do them, but there might be better ways to do something. And anti-patterns, we can come up with lots of examples where people say, hey, it's great here, not so great there. Once again, it's all about making sure you've got the right pattern for the right situation. In this particular case, we've got a pattern called hide and hover. I can interact with this photo on Facebook, but I don't know what my options for interaction are until I mouse over that photo. And in and of itself, that seems like a perfectly obvious interaction, but when you extend this pattern across a much larger site, you begin to realize that people have to mouse over almost every piece of content before they know whether or not they can interact with it. So we're taking time and effort from them to cruise around the page, to go cursor surfing, to try and figure out, can I interact here or not, and what can I do? And maybe their time could be better spent elsewhere. And then there are dark patterns. Dark patterns have malicious intent. They lead you into doing things that you would not otherwise choose to do. On this particular site, there are hidden links to the ads in the empty space margins on other side of the content. So if you intentionally or unintentionally click or tap outside the content area, you go to the advertiser's page. You get misdirected. It takes you to a place you didn't expect to go, and it's not something that you intended to do. Especially when we're talking about tablets, where your thumb can stray onto the page, you easily find yourself being navigated away from the content that you wanted to read. I really did not want to go check out that advertiser's site. We have to be careful when we are creating patterns, because new and different is not always better. Now, new patterns evolve, new patterns emerge. I'm not saying that new patterns are a bad thing. We just have to be sure that the new pattern is a better solution than the existing pattern, that it is appropriate for the situation, and that people are going to be able to learn it and use it. In the late 1950s, Ford introduced the Edsel. It had some amazing technology around safety and the engine, but it was also really heavy, underpowered, and poorly manufactured. So there were some ideas, some patterns that were good, and some implementations that were not. And of course, we know this today, the word Edsel is just sort of synonymous with failure. We are also concerned as designers with scope creep. It's one of the worst phrases in our vocabulary. A friend of mine once said, scope creep, ha, I wish, I deal with scope jog or scope run. So the rate at which the scope increases obviously varies. So things like forgotten features, oh yeah, it also needs to do this. Absent stakeholders who provide their feedback much later on in the process, or vendors and partners that you have to work with who suddenly say, oh yeah, you know, if you want our system to work with your system, you're going to have to do X, Y, or Z in order to implement that. Things that we didn't necessarily foresee. And then, of course, there's the dreaded executive bungee jumping, where late in the process, the executive comes to the meeting just to check in and then tells you something like, oh, you know what? It needs to be green, and I've got this video that my kid made that'll be awesome on the home page. And then they leave and expect to see a final product that's terrific later on. And finally, we have to deal with constraints and requirements. So things like technical constraints. The glass isn't strong enough, okay? Or legal requirements. We have to get the customer to accept this this disclaimer. Anyone who's ever worked in financial services, healthcare, or software knows this. At some point in the middle of whatever you are trying to do, there is a fine print legal document that pops up on the screen that requires you to accept and continue. And what does that do, of course? It just completely drops the focus on the task. It's like, no, I can't play the game now. I've got to accept the EULA before I can download it and install it. And then maybe business unit requirements. Marketing comes and says, you know what? On this newsletter sign-up page, we've got to get their birth date. Why? Is it really necessary to collect that information? Well, we're going to send them a reminder on their birthday every year. A reminder for what? How valuable is that? But if we have to include it, if we lose the battle, we know it complicates the experience. So here's an example that sort of does all three of these things. This is a brokerage site where you can purchase a stock online. But there are some questions that people have when they see this, like what's the current price per share? And why can't I buy a certain total value? I just want to buy $500 worth. Why can't I do that? Well, there are technical constraints here. The price of a stock changes on a millisecond by millisecond basis, and we can't deliver real-time updates to the website that quickly. The other problem is that once you hit the buy button, your transaction is not instantly processed. There's actually a delay, and it may take a few minutes before you actually own that stock, and the price will have changed again. So technically, I can't give you the price of that stock in the future at the point at which your transaction will be finalized. because I can't do that technically, the legal people say we can't allow you to buy certain ways and we can't show you certain pieces of information. Otherwise, it sets the expectation that you're going to get X shares for Y dollars. And that's never the case. And we don't want to get sued. And then there are business requirements that say, since we can't do it technically and since the legal department won't let us do this, we're just not going to show it and we're not going to give you the option at all. You have to tell me how many shares you want and then hope you have enough money for it. So, people. How do people deal with increasing complexity? Well, we already talked about how they talk about things in terms of difficulty. So don't conflate complexity with difficulty. They're actually different things. When we talk about difficulty, we say that they appear complex, but it's only because we don't yet have the knowledge or skills necessary to actually complete the task or to do it efficiently. High cognitive load is what leads to the perception of difficulty. So what's high cognitive load? If I feel like I'm spending a lot of time and effort making sense of things and remembering things, what does this mean? How many steps is that? If I'm spending all of my time trying to solve problems or make decisions, which choice? I don't know how to get out of the maze. Or making associations and connections between things. All of these require a tremendous amount of cognitive effort. And the harder we have to think, the more difficult and complex we are likely to judge the task. So, people deal with this increasing complexity by developing expertise. And they do that through time and practice. When we're learning a new skill for the first time, we start off with what's called declarative knowledge. This is stuff that we can repeat to ourselves. Think of it as like verbal information or written information. You hear your own voice in your head telling you what to do and what to do next. But as we practice that, it becomes procedural. We translate that verbal, that voice in my head information into motor actions and motor memory. And suddenly we just start to do this. And it feels like we have less attention that we need to pay to it. And then once we've practiced long enough, we end at automaticity, where it doesn't really take much attention at all anymore. I just know how to do it. Tying my shoes, driving a car, typing, all of those are tasks that started with a certain degree of complexity and difficulty, but now seem perfectly simple and easy to us. Even though driving a car is not, and tying your shoes actually isn't that simple of a knot. So in software, we often deal with novices and experts by helping them learn, right? So touch apps are new to a lot of people. We have to show them this is how you make it work. So the first couple times they use it, they reference the instructions. Oh yeah, this is the declarative stuff. Read this, touch that, drag here, tap over there, this is the gesture. But once we learn it, the instructions are no longer necessary. It all becomes procedural and people simply interact. And then they become faster and more efficient. And when that happens, they say, oh, it's simple, right? So you're very experienced on using digital interfaces, and you know those conversations you have with people in your family who are not. And you're thinking, it's so easy, why don't they get it? And they're thinking, it's so hard, why does this person think I'm stupid? Right? It's because you have automatic behaviors or procedural knowledge, and they have declarative, and they're still trying to figure it out. But they'll eventually get there. That's how we deal with complexity. We learn. And technology contributes to it because there are often limitations, right? Things like the materials. Sorry, it's not strong enough. Manufacturing. I can't make it small enough. Or technological capability. We can't make it fast enough to do that. But the good thing is that technology and science inexorably move forward. On the left is one of the first digital media players. In the middle is the Diamond Rio PMP 300. It was the first really successful digital media player, MP3 music player. And then, of course, everyone recognizes on the right iPad or iPod. Geez, everyone's got iPad on the brain. iPod 1, the first generation. How many of you remembered that there was such a striking visual similarity between the Diamond Rio and the iPod when it first came out? Yeah, people totally forget that. It's new. It's revolutionary. No, it's got a big round thing on the front and a screen above it. Right? It was a different interaction, but it wasn't a completely new pattern for people. So, what can we do about complexity? How do we address this? First thing we need to recognize is that not everything should be simple. if there is the possibility of making an irreversible mistake, we want to be careful about oversimplifying. It's probably not a good idea to have Amazon's one-click action implemented in nuclear missile silos. So we're going to use the law of parsimony to guide us. All things being equal, simpler solutions are generally better than complex ones. No surprise here. Let's take a look at the second half of our complexity curve now. We're at the feature complete point. What's on the downside here? How do we actually maintain the functionality but make it easier? Well, we iterate is one of the key things, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But if we continue to work on the design and refine the design, the first thing that we can do is achieve a better sense of clarity, right? We can reduce the confusion, reduce the ambiguity, and get clearer content and clearer purpose. If we continue to iterate and polish that design, we improve the structure and the organization. It's like the skeleton gets better on the inside. And when that happens and we iterate a bit further yet, we make refinements to the flow and we find opportunities for efficiency and accuracy, and things just seem to go much more easily. So how do we achieve this? Let's start backwards. We're going to start with technology and the users, because these are things over which we have the least control, and then we'll end with what we can do as designers. So one thing is we need to look for advances and new opportunities in technology. Are there new materials and manufacturing opportunities for us? I love this site. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Inventables, but this is probably the first place you'll ever be able to buy a high-temperature superconductor. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that they sell here, you know, molding putties and plastics and magnets and really amazing stuff that people tinker with. And that's where a lot of new things come from. We also have to have patience in technology, right? So we know that Pulsar put their watch out, their first LED watch, the digital watch, in 1972. What people don't realize is that what inspired that watch was that the Hamilton Clock Company was approached by Stanley Kubrick in the mid-1960s to create two conceptual clocks for inclusion in this little movie he was making. In 1968, 2001, A Space Odyssey was released, and these clocks make fleeting appearances, like one-frame appearances in the movie. But they inspired the people at Hamilton to say, we can actually make this happen. This doesn't have to be science fiction 40 years in the future. We can sell this. And it took them 4 years to make it happen, but the Pulsar watch was a huge success, and we've had digital watches on our wrists ever since. But they waited 4 years. It took them 4 years of hard work and patience to make that happen. And then there are forces that pull the technology forward. Things like the Retina display and the new iPad. That wasn't possible just a couple years ago. But the need, the demand, and the desire for that pushed technology. The Tesla Roadster has one of the most advanced battery systems in the world because that design pulled the technology forward. So we can have some influence, but it does take patience. How do people deal with complexity and reducing complexity? Well, one thing to remember is that a sufficiently motivated person is going to tolerate a lot of crap. If it's the only way that you can get something done that you need to do, you will do it that way, right? It doesn't have to be that way, but they will tolerate complexity. They will tolerate difficulty, and they will tolerate confusion. But this is only when they are sufficiently motivated, and they should not have to tolerate these things. That's why we're going to end from the designer's perspective. Sometimes we need to teach people. They want to learn, and so we need to have a system for teaching them. And this is often because we can't make it any simpler. It may be a truly difficult task, and so we have to assist them. We do this with the transfer of knowledge and skills, and every one of us does this every time we're faced with a new problem or a new challenge. We take what we know and we look for similarities between the existing knowledge and the new situation. We look for instructions that tell us explicitly how to do something. We look for people that can show us how to do it, or we watch videos, or we look over their shoulders. And we look for analogies. Oh, doing A is almost like doing B, and I know how to do B, so let me take what I do in B and try that on A. We do it naturally all the time. It's just one of our problem-solving skills. So now let's take a look at design. How do we tackle complexity from a design perspective? First off, I encourage everyone in here to leverage your ignorance. You know that energy you have at the beginning of the project before you know how complex it really is? That's when you have those awesome ideas. And it's those awesome ideas that somewhere along the line, someone tells you, you can't do that. So these ideas get shackled by constraints that arise during the course of the project. So we should write them down before we know why we can't do them, right? Preserve the energy, preserve the idea and the opportunity. And then when we've been told we can't do something, go back to those ideas. And instead of asking, why can't I, ask, how else can I, right? Don't just get rid of the idea. Go back to it and say, you know, this was a good one. Let's see if we can make it happen. When you're designing, always make sure you are putting people first, the end user. And this is a whole other hour talk, so we're not going to go too far into this. But there's four things, just four, that you can consider when you're designing for people. So design for motivation. What drives them? What are they trying to accomplish? What is their goal? Design for behavior. How are they going to act and interact? What are they going to do? Design for emotion. How is it going to make them feel? Most of us don't begin our projects thinking, I am going to design something to frustrate my people. Right? We want them to feel good. Everyone here, everyone at this entire conference has said, make your people happy, right? Make them feel good. And the fourth one is creativity, right? We have this innate generative sense about us. We like to make. We like to create. We're curious. We explore. We discover. We play. We should be able to find opportunities to leverage this creativity to engage people. So if we just think about these four factors when designing for people, it really influences how we make our design decisions. We want to make sure that we're using mental models. We've already talked about those. So we want to make sure that we match the conceptual model. How I am designing something matches how someone expects it to work. And we want to make sure that we hide the system models. Unless you really need to see how the guts are working, I don't need to expose it. Now, that said, I did think of one thing this morning. I just recently ordered a new mechanical watch, and I'm really excited about it because it has a glass back. In other words, I can turn it over and see the inner workings. I could never put one together, and I really don't understand how it works, but just to look at it, it's amazing. All those tiny little bits moving around, and it tells me time. And it's a mechanical watch, so it's easy to change the time. People's mental models evolve over time. So just the idea of what it means to cook has changed over the centuries, right? From open fire to hearth to wood stove to electric stove to microwave. And our conceptual models, the way that we design and craft solutions, change. On the left, we have the BlackBerry, one of the early editions. And on the right, of course, we have the iPhone. Now, if you just squint a little bit and you take a look at that BlackBerry, you can imagine quite easily that this is nothing more than a miniature laptop that has been stretched open. A screen, a keyboard, and a little trackpad, or in this case, a roller ball, right? Laptops were the conceptual model that we were using when this device was created. Let's make a miniature laptop and put a phone in it. Yay! Right? And then a new concept came along, a new way of doing things. And so now we have the iPhone. Saw a fantastic image the other day where people said it was one half of the image was pictures of feature phones the day before the iPhone was announced, and then the other was cell phones today, and everything looked like the iPhone on one side and everything looked different on the other. Okay, so we want to focus people. We want to focus their attention. We want to focus their flow, keep them moving forward, keep them on task. But we also want to look for opportunities to reduce. We want to reduce the amount of effort that it takes to do things, the amount of time that it takes to complete a task. And we want to reduce the opportunity or the chances or the number of errors that they may make along the way. However, once again, caveat here, Simplicity is not just about reduction. Our tendency is to say, well, make it easier by taking stuff out. And that's not always going to be the best result. So we have to be careful that we don't confuse subtraction with simplification. Make everything as simple as possible, but not simpler. We've all heard Einstein say this, right? If we take too much out, we may make the experience complex inadvertently. Another curious thing about complexity is that it seems to move on us. We think we've resolved it in one area, and then it pops up somewhere else. So we've got this movie projector, which was purely mechanical and needed to have the film threaded and a bunch of knobs to be twiddled in order to watch something at home. Then the VCR came along, and I don't know if you remember early VCRs, but they had all of these mechanical bits to them, literally like dials and buttons and switches. But then they simplified and became more digital. TiVo and the DVRs came along, and then Roku, and suddenly the entire button and interface was gone, just a plastic box. And the next generation of Roku may be nothing more than a USB stick that you plug into your television, right? I'm still watching movies at home, but I'm doing it through a very different experience. The complexity has gone from the mechanical projector to a series of microprocessors embedded in a bit of plastic and plugged into a television. So it has simply shifted, and we have to deal with it in different ways. So one of those things that we often are faced with is trying to figure out how to push that complexity forward. So Luke Rebluski generously shared these next two slides with me from a recent presentation of his. This first slide is the three steps that you had to go through in order to purchase online access to the Boingo wireless networks. Three mobile pages, 17 data fields, just to pay to get access to the network. And he proposed a simpler solution. He said, why don't we shift the complexity away from the person, collect only the data that are necessary, reduce effort, reduce the amount of time, and instead of having them fill in forms that required data in specific formats and had to do it across multiple form fields, why don't we create a smart credit card form where once I hit the 16th digit in my credit card number, it automatically asks me for my security number. And when that three-digit number is entered, it automatically asks me to type in the expiration date. And it's all done in one dynamic field. We've shifted the complexity here from the user having to look at all of this information and type stuff in to the developer who has to build this dynamic form and implement it in a functional, workable way. It's easier for the person to pay and get access. It's harder to create the system. So we've just shifted the complexity. And that's a good general rule for us. We should be doing the work, not shunting it back to the people. It's okay for us to deal with the complexity. And all of this has led me to think, maybe there's some type of law of conservation of complexity, right? Like, we don't ever really get rid of it. We just hide it or move it somewhere else, and we're going to be faced with it eventually. So feature complete is not experience optimized. We need to continue to work on our product, on our design. And we do this, as I said, primarily through forms of iteration. But there's other stuff that goes along with that iteration, with continuing to work on our product. One is incubation. Step away from what you're doing. Take a break. You know, give your mind a rest. Do something else for a little while. Come back to it with a fresh perspective. Cross-pollination. Do other things. You never know where your ideas are going to come from. Who knows? Maybe the indie film you see here tonight generates an idea that becomes a solution when you go back to work at the end of this week. And observation. Watch what is going on. Watch what people do. You may have heard the phrase, pave the cow paths, right? It's like, watch where people are going and then make it easier for them to do what they're already trying to do. And we can do this through iterative cycles. And when we do this, new solutions have a way of making themselves obvious. Coat hangers, we all use them, but they've got a problem. They stretch out the neck of your shirts, right? And who really wants to spend all of your time putting the coat hanger in from the bottom of the shirt? So you just think a little bit, and you watch what people are doing, and a new idea emerges. What if we built the hanger with a different shape? Or what if we built the hanger with a different material? And now I don't have to stretch out the neck of that T-shirt. I just change the way I use the hanger. It turns the model around a little bit, right? I'm not putting the effort onto the person. I'm shifting it to the device, to the object. None of these solutions and innovations are possible without one thing, though, and this is the key ingredient in everything that we're talking about: critical thinking. Anyone who's majored in science and taken experimental methodology or research methodology has probably had this hammered home into you. But basically, you just need to really think hard about everything you are doing. We know that these are things as designers we do. We ask, gather, identify, generate ideas, communicate the solutions. But critical thinkers go a few steps further. They recognize when we're making assumptions. Oh, you know what? I should question that. They assess the relationships and the connections among things, and they consider the consequences of the design options. And they really look for that optimal solution. So, designing for simplicity. This is not about checklists, formulas, patterns, or rules. You're not going to walk out of here with a nice little sheet that says, to achieve complexity, do the following things, right? What it really is thinking and reasoning. Take the time to think about the problem you're facing. Understand it. And analyze the options and look for the optimal solutions. It's much more about the thinking process than it is about making sure you've done a certain set of deliverables. So, how do we make stuff simpler? We're going to summarize. I just said I'm not going to give you a checklist, but I am going to give you a list of opportunities for simplicity. If you see these things happening in your project, you probably have a chance to simplify. So, you'll probably recognize these. If you hear people say, it's messy and confusing, you have an opportunity to simplify. Because there's irrelevance. It's not what they need. There's disorganization. The structure is poor. There's ambiguity, and it's messing them up. They don't understand it, right? Opportunity to simplify. If you are using indirect action, do something here to make something happen over there. There's an opportunity to simplify because you've abstracted and disconnected the action from the outcome, right? And you've increased the cognitive load. How does this work? And then they have to figure it out and think about it. If you're trying to be everything to everyone, right? We're going to hit our entire market base. Well, you probably have too many variables and you probably have too little focus. You have an opportunity to simplify. If you're working on a team that is driven by design by consensus, you're going to have some challenges here, right? Because this is a fantastic source of scope creep, unless, of course, that's your goal. But it could be a worse outcome. If you find people saying, it would be nice to have, then you have an opportunity to simplify. Because this introduces noise, clutter, and excess. There's going to be too much in the end. If you're copying solutions because they seem to work in another similar situation, you may have an opportunity to simplify because you may have misapplied that design pattern. If you're mapping the structure of the experience to the structure of the organization or to the constraints and limitations of the technology, you've exposed the system model and you have the opportunity to simplify. If you're leading with technology, we have this fantastic thing that does X. You may be solving the wrong or a non-existent problem. Let's pause for a second and talk about this particular one, because there are times when leading with the technology might not be bad, but we have to ask, is what we have created a solution that's looking for a problem, or do we have a tremendous opportunity, right? So sometimes the new can be great, but that's why critical thinking is so important. That's when it helps us identify the opportunity from the lost cause. If you're designing for yourself, I want it to work this way, and I want it to do this, you probably have an opportunity to simplify because you're ignoring the mental models of the people who will really be using it. If you're accepting assumptions, we have to do it this way, or just assume that that is going to be available to us, or just assume that people will enter this information. Well, you're not actually collecting data to evaluate what your options are, and you're not questioning those assumptions. This indicates the absence of critical thinking, and you probably have the opportunity to simplify. So here you go, my list of 10. It may be complex if. For those of you who have been taking photos, this is probably the one slide that you wanted instead of the 10 or 12 that preceded it. So I'll leave it up here for a moment. If you find yourself in situations where you are doing or saying these things, you probably have the opportunity to make your design better, to reduce the complexity, and to simplify. And thank you this afternoon. I'm not sure if we have time for questions.